Hi, Marco here. January will be here before we know it, and that means time is running short to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. A sincere thank you to everyone who has already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year. It truly means a lot. Your gift helps ensure that we are able to continue this crucial work. And if you haven't donated yet, now is the time. We need you. Your donation goes far beyond dollars and cents. It validates the importance of our work and enables us to tell the stories that matter to listeners like you. You're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.
Celebrating Christmas in America, Persian style. One Muslim father got creative for his four-year-old daughter who wanted a traditional Christmas.
From my story, she learned that Santa actually has a twin sibling who is just as nice and giving as Santa himself.
A twin who would, of course, bring her presents. And how small acts of kindness change people's lives. I'm Carol Hills. Also, a given name can bring unexpected strength.
There's no shame in a name, because a name is who you are, and there is never any shame in that.
And immigrants coming to America bring with them a slice of home.
They carried bottles of pickles, goose feathers. They carried Bibles, live goats.
Those and more personal stories are ahead on this Christmas Day special of The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Happy holidays and Merry Christmas to those celebrating. We have a special show for you on this day that's all about connecting with one another, sharing stories with family over a holiday meal or just a day off. We're bringing you personal stories of people connecting with each other and their heritage, with a special focus on the immigrant experience in America. We begin with an Iranian immigrant who started a new holiday tradition for his family. Hadi Shavarini came to America after the revolution in Iran in 1979, and it wasn't easy to assimilate into a foreign country.
When I landed in New York, I remember, without knowing anybody and without speaking a word of English, I was terrified. And it's been very difficult for me to become an American. Along the way, you have to get rid of some of the old habits, some of the old culture, and create a whole brand new beginning.
Part of that new beginning included a blended Christmas with a Persian touch.
Holiday traditions like Christmas, we inherit them. Like, I was born in a traditional Shia Muslim family in a small village northwest of Iran. While I grew up with Nowruz, the Iranian New Year, the holy month of Ramadan, and Ashura of Shia, my daughter, on the other hand, grew up in the historic town of Lexington, Massachusetts, with Christmas tree and Santa Claus. She was not even 4 years old when she learned from her childhood friend across the street that she's showered with gifts on Christmas. That is exactly when she started bugging me. Demanding like a little dictator to have a Christmas tree so Santa could drop in. I suppose I could have, just like a good father, made pretend and have belief in Santa Claus. I could have just gone down the hill and bought her a Christmas tree, light it up by the fireplace, and wait for Santa to show up. I really wanted to create that holiday magic for her, but I couldn't. I couldn't pretend, not in my mid-40s. And for once, I really wished I should have been born here. To a Christian parents, "Didn't Santa come visit you when you were a child?" she pleaded with her big dark brown eyes befitting of a Persian princess. I could have just told her Santa doesn't exist. Be done with it. put my foot down like my own father would have done. But like a good father, I realized I was dealing with a four-year-old. And I didn't tell her anything about Santa not ever showing up when I was a child. But I was adamant. I was not going to surrender to her demand and start make-believe in a fairy that was not around when I was her age. I decided if there were going to be a holiday tradition for us, especially one with a fairy, I wanted her to believe in my fairy for once. For that, I had to think very quickly because I was dealing with a four-year-old who was in the middle of throwing a temper tantrum. I realized I had two problems I had to address with her. Problem number one, somehow I had to find an explanation for her why I was not born in a Christian family. I had to explain to her that it's not my fault that Christmas tree is not among the trees that are mentioned in the Quran. I didn't write the book. Problem number two, what would I tell her about Santa Claus? How was I going to explain his absence during my childhood? And that's when I let the creative juices flow. And I did what a good immigrant like me should do in situations like this. That's right. Blending some of the old with the new, I created our own winter tradition. And while I was at it, I ordered a fairy to come along with it. That is when I told her about the Village of Light. From my story, she learned that Santa actually has a twin sibling who is just as nice and giving as Santa himself, whose job is to deliver presents for all the special kids like her who happen to be born to non-Christian parents like me. In the story, she discovered that when winter solstice arrives, Yalda, who is the Iranian symbol of winter solstice, will come down the chimney and bring her present. If she were to be a good girl, behave and stop the tantrum at once. Instead of a Christmas tree, we ended up building a beautiful, delicate ceramic village in our living room and lit it up. A village that had everything for Yalda's visit. A hotel, a restaurant, homes with people, a barber shop, even a library. We made sure to light up the street of the village with real traffic lights and lampposts and trees with colorful, shimmering lights. You should have seen her eyes. Radiant, truly like a Persian princess. Proud and excited, she sets a tray with an assortment of Persian cookies and Persian hot tea and puts it right next to the village and waits for Yalda to arrive. That winter, and many more winters after that, she wrote a letter. And together, we went to Lexington Center post office and mailed it to Yalda. I am glad I put my foot down for once. My daughter now keeps her inheritance in a big box in a closet down in our basement. Every winter solstice, before Yalda arrives, she brings the big box upstairs to our living room, sets the village, lights it up, and waits for Yalda to arrive. She tells me she cannot wait to tell the Yalda story to her own children.
Hadi Shavarini's story of Yalda is from Stories from the Stage, produced by our partners at GBH World TV. Moving to a new country means packing up your life, literally getting all your stuff into bags and boxes, and psychologically preparing for the new life you'll have somewhere else.
We immigrants, we learn to carry things. We pack and unpack, and we take our homes with us.
Teacher Eva Kruschiel knows this personally. Eva shared the comical side of what she carried with her when she came to the U.S. from Poland.
I once took a sausage with me. A Polish sausage, mind you. It might not taste any different from American or Israeli sausage, but it's a Polish sausage. I bought it at the airport before I left Poland. And it was sealed tightly, so I thought it was okay. And then on the flight, I sort of started to have bad premonitions. So I asked a flight attendant, and she told me to eat it right away. But I fell asleep instead. And I only woke when it was time to exit the flight. So I promised myself to throw the sausage away in the nearest bathroom, and I kept walking. I grew up in the communist regime, and the food was scarce, and I don't like to waste food. So I kept walking, thinking, if God lets my sausage in, I will eat it like a saint. Circle a table with Gregorian chants. So the baggage carousel spat my luggage out, and I looked around, and I quickly transferred my sausage from carry-on to the checked luggage. And I kept walking towards the customs, praying for my sausage. And the officer pulled me aside, and my luggage went through a sausage scan. And he said, "What is it?" And I said, "It's a sealed sausage." And he said, "But you declared no meat." And I said, "Sealed sausage is not a meat. Sealed sausage is a sealed sausage." He looked puzzled. So I repeated with determination, "Sealed sausage is a sealed sausage." And he looked blinded, as if this hypnotic alliteration threw him back into the waters of his childhood. So, in the end, my sausage got arrested, and I had to promise that I understood that sausage was a meat. Had it not been confiscated, perhaps I would have sent it to the Vatican to become a relic. And this sausage incident gave me a desire, an appetite for more. So I started to research the things that immigrants carry with them. And I went actually a few times to Ellis Island to track the historical objects. And they carried barrels of pickles, goose feathers. They carried Bibles. They carried rosaries, honeymoon dresses, live goats. There was a Swedish woman who carried a stained sheet used in her family to give birth only. And she wanted to show it to her new doctor. And then I thought, what were the invisible things that they carried or they were sneaking through the customs? Albert Sabin, a pauper from Białystok in Poland, carried a live virus, the vaccine that eliminated polio from the United States. Khalil Gibran, an Arab, carried a live virus of poetry that soon became his famous book, The Prophet. Paula Negri carried the dreams of stardom, and she became a Hollywood star. So we immigrants like to carry things, and we do not throw easily away cheese wrappers and glass jars from our country. And you could wonder, what do those silly attachments stand for? I think they stand for something much bigger. It could be our desire to not to lose our identity, or a desire to find a new identity. So you might say, I lost my sausage, but I found the poetics of smuggling. Thank you.
The poetics of smuggling. I love that. That was teacher Eva Kruschiel. We first aired her story this summer. It's from Stories from the Stage, a program where ordinary people tell extraordinary stories. It's produced by GBH's World TV Network. You can find them at worldchannel.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. For many, the holidays are about helping others. Some people volunteer at shelters. Others donate gifts. These small acts of kindness can make a huge difference in people's lives. Julianne Whitney found out years later about the impact she had by writing letters to her brother's Navy buddies.
30 years ago, my big brother Pete enlisted in the U.S. Navy. He was a senior in high school, and he had everything going for him. He was getting his varsity letter in 3 sports. He was homecoming king, and he was also the king of all parties. Every single weekend my parents were gone, the kegs came in. So when he went off to the Navy, part of me was kind of like, thank God. It's like some peace until war. Right after he enlisted, he was deployed. And he was sent on a ship across the Pacific to the Persian Gulf for the first Iraq War. And that changed our relationship. We started writing letters. He was the person that could make me feel better about high school, about life, about everything that goes on for a teenager. And the whole time he's being supportive of me, I had no idea how bad it was for him. This is the first time he was ever away from home. He was 18 years old, 6'3", and stuck in child-sized quarters with no fresh air, no fresh water, no fresh food, months on end at sea with people who were basically strangers. And one day he sends me a letter and he says, you know what? I get all these letters from home. I get letters from mom and dad, all the brothers and sisters. And you know what? There are guys here who are now my buddies that don't get letters. They don't have anybody at home. Could you please send them some letters? So I did. And, you know, I sent the same things that I would send to my brother. Complaining about not going to the prom. Complaining about, you know, what happened at the latest track meet. And all these guys, they did the same thing. They bucked me up. They were all like, hey, it's not so bad. You can do this. And they were on their way to war. They became like my big brothers. After a year, after sharing all these letters and photos and care packages, they all went on to new assignments. I went off to college, and we stopped staying in touch. And I never met any of those guys until just last year. My brother got promoted to major. He had transferred to the Army, and he decided to have one of his epic parties where he invited everyone, Army buddies, Navy buddies, family, friends. And as soon as the doors open, in walk his buddies and in walks Cash. He's one of the guys that I shared the most letters with. And I took one look at him and I knew, even though it was like, you know, decades later, that's the guy. That's the guy I used to share letters with. And I think to myself, do I mention the letters? Do I not mention the letters? I just decided, you know what, let it go. Enjoy the night, have some fun. And it turned out that he was the one who actually performed the promotion for my brother. He did an amazing toast. There wasn't a dry eye in the house, especially my family, because we're all huge crybabies. And the night went on great. And my big mouth stayed shut about those letters. Until the next morning, we all end up meeting up at the local diner. And in walks the Navy buddies and in walks Cash. And they start talking about how Pete used to get the best letters and the best care packages, and now they could see why, because they actually, for the first time, could see this big, huge family. I said, well, yeah, I was like, you know, that's just what we do. I was like, you know, it was nice to send him letters and to send some of the other guys letters too. And they're like, we love that stuff. You know, anything from home, it's like, it meant everything to us. And we're finishing breakfast and everybody's saying goodbye, and Cash comes over to me and he gives me the biggest hug. And he whispers in my ear and he says, I was one of those guys. And I said, I know.
Julianne Whitney there on the enduring power of the written word. Now, a story that starts from the other side of a kind gesture, the receiving end. Biar Khan is a Sudanese man who grew up in a Kenyan refugee camp. His story is about a lesson he learned from a kind stranger.
At 17,
I was ready for the biggest moment of my life, sitting for my national examination. But I've lived in a refugee camp since I was 3 months old. But now that I moved to Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, I'm excited to join better schools. But that is when I was told, in order for you to sit for your national exam, you need your birth certificate. But unfortunately, for a lot of us who are refugee, we didn't have them. Then the family told me the only way I could retrieve my birth certificate was to go to the Sudanese embassy. I found myself on the busy street of Nairobi, looking for the embassy, asking strangers for direction. After encountering about 6 strangers, none knew where the embassy was. But then I was stopped by an older woman with this beautiful curly hair. She spoke to me in Swahili, which is the national language of Kenya, and asked, "Are you okay? Are you looking for something to eat, direction, or a place to stay?" That is when I realized she thought I was homeless. It's not uncommon in Kenya to see homeless people on the street, even children asking for food and money. I smiled and I told her no, I wasn't looking for something to eat. I was actually looking for the direction to the embassy. And she smiled. She said the embassy is down the block, and she offered to walk me there. We had a conversation, and she told me, "The reason why I stopped you is because I'm a mother first, before anything. And as a mother, I feel obligated to help in any little way that I can when I see a child on the street." That then reminded me of my mother. Even when we were in a refugee camp and had little to nothing, she always shared with those who did not have. Went to the embassy. I told her thank you, waved goodbye, got my birth certificate, registered for my exam, and it all went well. 3 years later, I was relocated to the United States of America. One thing I didn't actually expect to see in America was the homelessness. When you live in a foreign country, America is seen as this beautiful country, one of the best, if not the best. So you would never think to see a homeless person in the United States. One morning while I was going to school, an incident happened when I bought my coffee. I saw a young man who looked very tired asking this young lady for some change. But the lady, instead of helping him, she was rude and started insulting him. I was shocked, and the young man had a stony face on because he felt humiliated. When the young lady walked away, I approached him and offered him one of my Dunkin'. And I told him, "I know how it feels to sleep with an empty stomach because I was once a refugee. And in a refugee camp, you have to rely on the generosity of others." On my way back to school, I thought of the woman, that woman in Kenya, the woman who was so eager to help me, even though she didn't know me. And she taught me a very important lesson. She told me, even though we might not always have the money to spare to other people or the homeless people, we can always give them the most important thing, and that is our time. Because they are human before anything, and that we should always treat people with respect and dignity.
Find more storytellers like B.R. Khan at worldchannel.org. You're listening to The World. Arriving in America on Christmas Day marks a moment of joy for this woman.
He stamped entry on my passport, and that was the best Christmas gift this Kurdish Muslim woman could ever get.
But after fleeing persecution, she finds that life in America is not as rosy as she'd hoped. Coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In our special Christmas edition of the show today, we're featuring storytellers who appeared on Stories from the Stage, a TV show produced by GBH's World TV. Names can be powerful, and knowing what they mean can often reveal a lot about who we are and where we came from. Umuleni Emlaba Adebo is originally from Zimbabwe. She celebrates her name as she sows the seeds of renewal in a new life in the United States.
My mother has a green thumb. Perhaps it's because she grew up on a farm in Chipinge in Zimbabwe, or perhaps she just has this gift of giving life to everything that she touches. When we go on long drives in Murambi in Zimbabwe, always in the back of a car is a little shovel and a small box. And any time we drive and she sees a small plant or a flower, she will stop the car and go out like a ballerina and with the gentle surgeon's precision lift that beautiful plant or flower and take it back home. She tasked me with watering the flowers. Not too much water, not too little, but always with love. She tells me that plants have feelings. And I can tell from the exploring paradise of a home that they love her right back. They are the lucky ones. I too am lucky. Like them, I grew in the seed that was my mother's body. I am told that my mother was a few days overdue when she had me. Apparently, there were still some things I needed to do. So my father said in his native tongue, his Ndebele, what are we waiting for? Umeleni. And thus, I have my given name. And so my lifelong mission has been to figure out how to answer that much loaded question. I was born in a small village in a small town called Leominster, Massachusetts. I don't know much about it at all. All the things that I'm told are apparently I was really obsessed with Sesame Street. My first words were, juice, mummy, juice. And I've seen pictures of myself in a pink snowsuit. I was 4 years old when we moved back to Rhodesia, right in time to be on the front lines of a revolution. I was too young to know, but young enough to feel the fear of gunshots in the night, the sound of gumboots and soldiers running through my grandmother's farm. And at night we would sleep in concentration camps. I was told it was to keep us safe. But we gained independence in 1980, and I grew in the new Zimbabwe, post-independence. I was lucky enough to go to private schools, and I loved school, particularly English and drama and music. And my teachers nourished that creative longing in my soul. And I also went to school in South Africa, and it was there I have one of my fondest memories of my high school teacher who coerced me into singing at a school variety show. I admit I was a little nervous. I used to sing with a choir in the safety of the cocoon of the choir, but this time she wanted me to do a solo. So I thought about what would I sing, and Tracy Chapman songs came in my mind. So I wanted to sing Last Night. Oh, I remember that moment when I sang it on stage. Everyone was quiet. And in that moment, oh my goodness, a star was born in my mind. And I remember dreaming of Mariah Carey songs and on Vogue, and I'd be on stage and people would be screaming. And my brother, he would be there. I would bind his restless legs and he would listen to my genius. I had really grand visions then. But isn't that what good teachers are supposed to inspire? You see, I was the seed. School was my soil and my teachers, they were the water. But the thing is, the arts weren't really a thing then. I needed to concentrate on more important things like math and physics and think about what I would do and be in the future. But I wanted something different. I wondered what would happen if I went into a new place, new soil. What kind of flower would I bloom? So I decided that I would do something different. I decided to come back to America on my own. I remember that long flight. I remember that time because I wasn't talking to my mom, although I did manage to coerce her to braid my hair in cornrows because I wanted to make doubly sure that people knew that I was African when I landed. I remember the biting cold. It was so cold, right down to my bones. And my biological father picked me up that day. And I remember as we were driving, he was telling me all the things I would expect in college. But all I could think of is, I missed the sun. I missed the sun like the soil must miss the rain. I missed the echo of my language. I even missed my baby brother. But this was new soil. You see, I wanted to carve out my own destiny. You see, most people immigrate because they're running away from something. And in my case, I was running away from the oppressive regime that was my parents. But I have to admit that when I was in college, I was really annoyed at a couple of things. First is, people would always question what kind of African I was. Why did I speak English so well? Who taught it to me? Did I have a pet lion? Things like that. And then they'd also want to touch my hair without permission, change my name to suit their palate. I really didn't appreciate that. But honestly, there were other times I really enjoyed myself. I took part in jazz band. I learned a lot about music. And interestingly enough, it is only in America when I came back I was able to reclaim my name. You see, no one in my family calls me Umeleni. My parents all call me Melanie or Mel or different variations depending on their mood. And it is only when I came to America and I started performing that I realized I need a stage name. So I started thinking of all these interesting names, and then I took a step back and realized, wait a minute, I have an interesting name. Umeleni, what are we waiting for? It's funny that it took me coming back to America to reclaim my name. But it makes sense because this was my beginning, right? This is the place of my birth. I've had the privilege and pleasure of performing on many stages and being warmly loved and received and acknowledged as an artist. You see, the seeds were planted in Africa, but the flower bloomed and continues to bloom here. I am a seed. I am an immigrant. I am Zimbabwean. I am American. We are all seeds, aren't we? Seeds that scatter, seeds that fall, seeds that are yearning, just yearning to grow.
That was Umeleni Amlaba Adebo sharing her story on stage. Another story now about the power of a name. Shifra Burke's parents were Holocaust survivors who came to the U.S. from Poland. Shifra wishes she had asked her family more about the past.
It's a bit of a mission for me to encourage children of refugees to dare to ask, even ask like lightweight things, because we're taught to stay away from anything historic. And then we don't have all this information, and our parents actually are ready to talk.
Burke's moving story is about how she found out the hidden truth behind her Hebrew name.
I'm 16 years old. I'm at City Hall with my younger sister, Roz. And I'm there for my birth certificate so that I can get my driver's permit. And I am psyched. So I tell the woman behind the counter, Susan Burke, B-I-R-K-E. And before I can even tell her my birth date, she says, "Oh, honey, I know your family. And that's not your name." And I think, I'm 16. I've lived with this for a long time. I think I know it's my name. She said, "It has a Z in it." And I think, oh, well, maybe they spelled Susan with a Z because my parents are Holocaust survivors. English was their fourth language, and they spelled, may we say, creatively. So she hands me back a piece of paper, a little white piece of paper, and she's right. It has a Z on it. It says S-Z-I-F-R-A, R, Burke. And it's June 28th, 1950. This must be me. But this is a me I have never seen before. Walking back to my parents' clothing store, my sister and I are like, Sifra, Zifra, Cifra, Zifra, until my sister breaks out in hysterical laughter and says, "Oh my God, Sue, they named you Shifra." I'm 16. I'm a cheerleader. I just want to be normal. Now I find out that I am going to be Shifra. Shifra is my Hebrew name. We get back to my parents' store. I show them this piece of paper. I am melting down near tears. They ignore me. They start this volley back and forth, or as my dad would say, forth and back. So, Sala, what is this R? I thought we named her Shifra Leah. Yeah, I thought we did too. I think I figured it out. I think we named her Ruchel. Ruchel. What does that sound like? Vomit, right? Ruchel. 25 minutes ago, I'm Susan Burke. No middle initial, no nothing. I'm just Susan Burke. Now, I am 16 years old, and I'm Shifra Ruchel Burke. That night, I'm like, so where did the Susan come from then, all these years? Well, a customer. We was calling you Shifra. A customer told us it's not a good name in America. We say, what should we call her? They tell us a good American name is Susan. So we called you Susan. I guess we forgot. Between that moment and going to college, I am back and forth, or forth and back, about, do I go as Shifra? Do I go as Susan? Do I go as, what do I do here? And I decide to take the plunge and go as Shifra. I tell people my name is Shifra when they ask, and they call me Shifra because I just told them that was my name. On the home front, my 8-year-old brother is deciding to be a big ally, and he tells people, my friends, when they call, we don't have a Sue or Susan who lives in our home, but we do have a Shifra if you would like to speak with her. I'm 30, living in Indiana, a couple of sons. People ask me about my name. I tell them the truth. Shifra was an Egyptian nursemaid. I tell them the half-truth. She was an Egyptian nursemaid, but I don't tell them the Jewish part of the story. I'm 50 years old with my mom sitting at her table, and my very stoic mom is staring at me very intently with tears in her eyes. My mother doesn't have tears in her eyes very often. I ask, like, so is everything okay? Yeah, Shif, everything's okay. Doesn't look like everything's okay. Well, I'm just thinking, looking at you, you look just like my mother. Well, I don't know if that's like a good thing or a bad thing, because my mother's mother, Shifra, and her father, and her brothers, and her sister, and the rest of the family were exterminated in the Holocaust, like my dad's family. So I decide to ask her, is this hard? And she says, well, yeah, it's hard, but it's a good hard, because I loved my mother. I loved her so much. And when I look at you, I see my mother, and I get to see her close and be close to her. I'm so glad we named you Shifra. And I'm so glad you named me Shifra too. It's been 51 years since that moment when I would have done anything to be the cheerleader Susan Burke. Today, when people ask me about my name, I tell them the whole story. I tell them that Shifra was one of the two very brave Egyptian nursemaids who refused to obey the Pharaoh's orders to kill the Jewish boy infants. That Shifra was my grandmother's name, and she was killed in the Holocaust. I tell them all sorts of things about my name, including the Jewish part of the story. I was too nervous at 30 to tell the Jewish part of the story and to talk about my name. Today, I couldn't be more proud, more honored to be able to share my name and to share this story for all the Shifras and all the Ruchels and all of the Lasers and Chaims and all of the people who couldn't tell their own story because they didn't survive to tell it.
Shifra Burke on celebrating the full meaning of her real name. Now, a name doesn't always trigger feelings of kinship and pride. Many Muslims in America face discrimination based on their names. Sophia Colombo Abdullah discovered this early on in her life. Our next story is from her.
The first time I was asked if I was a terrorist was when I was 9 years old. I had just moved to Northern Virginia from Atlanta, Georgia. In Virginia, I was surrounded by mostly only white kids. In Atlanta, my classroom was filled with children of color. My first class of fifth grade was language arts in Mrs. Hines' class. To begin the year, Mrs. Hines started off with the roll call. My last name begins with a C, so I'm near the beginning of the attendance list. She gets through the A's and the B's, and then we're here. Sophia Colombo Abdullah. Her pronunciation is miles off, but that's expected. What I didn't expect was the kid next to me, a blonde-haired boy with blue eyes, taking a long lean towards me, looking me straight in the eyes, and then saying, "Are you a terrorist? Your name sounds like a terrorist name." I was 9. I had no idea what terrorist even meant. I hadn't grown up in Northern Virginia, which, with its proximity to D.C., was still reeling from the effects and the persistent presence of the 9/11 attacks. And it had just never come up. I was too young for my parents to ever discuss it with me. But from his question, I knew that it wasn't good, that I wasn't seen as good. For years, I hated my name. It grated on me, a lot. In its entirety, it is a whopping 26 letters long. My first name is Sophia, and it has just enough foreignness to draw a little attention to it with its spelling. Eventually, though, I did get some confidence. The internet told me that Sophia was Greek for wisdom, Greek like Athena, the goddess of wisdom. Urban Dictionary told me that Sophia was a name that was vivacious and full of life. Well, the meaning that I really delighted in was the one that my mother told me. She told me that she named me for a queen, the Queen of Spain to be exact, Me, Queen Lee. How many other people could say that? And for the first time, I really took pride in being Sophia. When I was 16, I took a trip with my father. We were on our way to Atlanta to go visit my grandmother. Dad and I have TSA PreCheck, so no shoes off and all of that. PreCheck makes you feel kind of human compared to the regular line stripping down process. We make it through TSA, and we head to our gate to wait. We wait, and then the boarding process begins. And the flight attendant conducting the boarding process is a short white lady with her hair cut and like a bob. We reach her, and my dad pulls out his phone. He has his ticket on his Apple wallet because he thinks he's very tech savvy. So he scans it, and as he's scanning the ticket, the flight attendant asks him a question. Are you sure you're on this flight? My dad, who has just scanned his ticket, says yes with confusion. Is there a problem? The flight attendant asks him another question. Are you sure you're cleared to be on this flight, Mr. Abdullah? My dad just says yes, calmly. I'm internally boiling. The question that she is asking is the same question that is hinted at towards thousands of Muslim people. It's the same question that construes this prejudiced view that so many people have towards Muslim and Muslim-presenting people. It's the, are you a terrorist? I will never forget what she said and how she said it. It was just like that boy when I was 9. After we land in Atlanta, we head to the SkyTrain to go through the terminals, and we get off at our designated stop, and my dad turns to me as we get on the escalators. And he doesn't express the frustration that I was most definitely feeling at that moment in time. He says to me, there's no shame in a name, because a name is who you are, and there is never any shame in that. My name is Sophia Jasmine Colombo Abdullah. It's Sophia con una, with an A. There's an accent over the I, but I go by Sophie because people never say it right. Sophia means wisdom. Jasmine means courage. Colombo means dove, a name given to Italian orphans. And Abdullah simply means servant of Allah, which is Arabic for God.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Rinaz Mala Muhammad arrived in the U.S. on a cold Christmas day. She fled Syria after the civil war began. Her family had lost everything. So immigrating to America was a gift for her. Muhammad's story begins on Christmas Eve in 1987, when she was just a child, still living a comfortable life back home in Syria.
My six-year-old self is too excited to sleep. Yes, we're Muslims, but we do celebrate Christmas. Like many other Muslim Syrian families, it's more associated with the new year. We like the tree, Santa, and the gifts. It's Christmas morning, and I got a large Barbie doll house with pool and towels for Barbie and Ken, which was an expensive gift at the time, but my father was able to afford it. He owned a textile factory. Although I was born in Aleppo, I'm not Arab like most of the people in Syria. I am a Kurd from my father's side and my mother's side too. The percentage of the Kurdish people is 10 to 12%. Due to my father's profitable business, we lived very well in Syria. We owned a large house in a rich neighborhood where Kurds couldn't afford to live. I went to a private school and learned English there. I have a Kurdish name, Rinaz, which means the one who knows the way. So people would ask me because of my Kurdish name, Rinaz, are you a Kurd? When I say yes, they say, oh, you don't look like one, as a compliment, I guess. But I didn't take it as one. What they really meant is, you don't look poor like the rest. To be a Kurd in Syria means you cannot speak your language. The government for a long time put a strategic plan to erase and destroy our Kurdish identity. They prohibited the use and publications of books and other materials in Kurdish. They also changed the names of the Kurdish towns into Arabic. While other minorities, like Armenians, were able to speak their language, have their own schools, and congregate in their own clubs. Growing up, I was taken by Shakespeare, Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, to name but a few. So I studied English literature. One day, my father was driving me to college. I had an exam. It's called politics exam, where you go and praise the government and its achievements. My father told me if you get any question about the Kurds, just skip that question. Here I am in my exam room. I got the paper and it was one essay question. What's your opinion about the latest protest conducted by the Kurds at the northern borders? I put the pen down, handed my paper, left college. We are 35 million Kurds scattered around the world with no home. We're Muslims, Christians, Jews, and Yazidi Kurds. It's not a religion, it's a nationality. The government took every right from us, even the right to speak. Kurds had faced many atrocities and genocides, and it's still happening. But of course, if I put this down, I would have been imprisoned, tortured, and even killed, like many other Kurdish activists who dared to speak. The government didn't bring us in the media, not in the news or newspaper or any media outlet. But they managed to say every bad thing about the Jews. I remember one time going back home telling my mom, these Jewish people are terrible. Both my mom and dad corrected me and said, this is not true. Jewish people lived in Aleppo. It had a large community. They were our friends and neighbors. They had to leave their houses and businesses and their memories behind. The war started. My father lost his factory. So the family wealth that used to bring us protection does not exist anymore. Eventually, I had to leave. It's Christmas Eve again. My 32-year-old self is too excited to sleep. It's Christmas morning and I am at JFK, too tired and exhausted. The officer at the airport told me, "Ma'am, are these your kids?" When we get married in the Middle East, we don't change our last names, so my kids have different last name. So I told him, "Do you think I will fly for 14 hours with two kids that aren't mine?" He smiled, but he still required an answer. So I said, "Yes." He stamped entry on my passport. And that was the best Christmas gift this Kurdish Muslim woman could ever get. But here I am again, as if the minority thing has to follow me like a curse. "What a beautiful accent you have. Where are you from?" "Syria." "Oh, you don't look like one." "Well, I always wanted to say you don't look like Julia Roberts or Tom Cruise either, but I never said that. Only once or twice." Aleppo was home. It was a beautiful city with the ancient citadel, the old market. The walk in the old market with the smell of the spices and the soap like a cleansing ritual. But it was safe because wherever you go, you meet people, you know. So I wanted to create the same feeling in Connecticut. I joined the Moms Club, where I got tons of support. And I learned a lot of things, from the difference between public and charter school, to know where to get the best strawberries, to make the best jam. I also learned that moms here talk about their mothers-in-law. The past 8 years were wonderful in the U.S. I only met kind and nice people. But unfortunately, my kids faced terrible insults in school. Like, "Do you belong to ISIS? How was life in a refugee camp?" A life they never experienced. I have to remind myself, although these comments are really hurtful, but these kids are being misinformed by what they see on some news channels or social media or family members. But I faced the same thing in Syria. When I told my mom that the media is covering wrong information about the Kurds, but my mom always used to tell me, "Wear your insecurities as a crown." So can you see my crown? It says Muslim Kurdish single mom from Syria. I keep reminding my kids that being called a refugee is not an insult. It's a badge of courage, honor, and victory.
Rinaz Mala Muhammad's story ends this special edition of our show. We hope you enjoyed all the stories from the stage today. They're produced by our GBH partners at World TV. You can find more at www.worldchannel.org.
Before we go, Marco here with a quick reminder. Time is running out to donate to our fundraiser and help us unlock a $67,000 matching gift. If you've been meaning to donate but haven't yet, we need you to step up now. Your gift will help sustain our newsroom into 2023. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.